we present the news quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Welcome to the news quiz. We start with a note addressed to guests in the Hilton Hotel, Abu Dhabi, read by Zeb Soans.
Dear guest, this is a non-smoking room. The ashtray is provided for your convenience.
Our thanks to Stephen Foster from Bath for sending us that. Now, will you welcome the teams on my right, Hugo Rifkin and Zoe Lyons. And opposite them, on my left, Susan Calvin and Paul Sinha. Hugo, who's done a great deal this week?
OK, Miles, this is Brexit, which is still going on, believe it or not. We're leaving the EU in 43 days, which, as my colleague Matt Chorley pointed out this morning, is the gestation period of a ferret. It's just good to know. And this week, the big issue is trade. Because, you see, an awful lot of our trade with the rest of the world is governed by the trade deals that we've negotiated as part of the EU. And now we're leaving the EU, we need to negotiate our own. This is the responsibility of Liam Fox, who is definitely the sort of man you'd want on your side in a hostage situation. If only so, you definitely weren't the one who got shot first. And he boasted... 2 years ago, he boasted that all this trade deal stuff was going to be sorted out in time. He said, believe me, we'll have up to 40 trade deals ready to go for 1 second after midnight in March 2019. Now, it's saying up to 40. That's a sort of quite a cunning way of putting it, because up to 40 really means 40 or fewer, doesn't it? Up to 40, as in I have 40 or fewer arms. You know, or like, you know, after Brexit, you'll be living off 40 or fewer calories a day. And indeed, as it turns out, we do not. Well, we do have 40 or fewer trade deals, quite a lot fewer. We don't have 40. We have 4. That is what we've negotiated so far in the 2.5 years Brexit has been going on. Of these 4, one is with Switzerland, which means after Brexit, we'll have lots of Toblerone and lots of little knives to stab each other to death with in fights over Toblerone. Another is with Southern and Eastern Africa, which mainly apparently involves getting tuna from Mauritius. Mauritius are very pleased. We're still going to be buying their tuna. And that's great, because when you're stepping out into the diplomatic cold of a new world, the country you really want to have your back is Mauritius. Another's with Chile, from whom we buy a lot of wine, so we're going to need that. And the last one is with the global trade powerhouse of the Faroe Isles. Which means we'll have some nice warm jumpers to wear after we've burned all the cars. That's what's happening in Brexit, Miles.
See, but you're gloomy about this, are you?
No, very, very cheerful.
Because there's other ones that are thrown in, of course. I mean, Switzerland, it's not just Switzerland. You get Liechtenstein as well.
A bog-off deal.
It's interesting that Liechtenstein is actually the world capital of the manufacture of false teeth. Which at least means they're playing to the Brexit audience. To it.
I mean, it's been quite negative, Miles, and often the BBC are accused of being quite negative about Brexit, and I'd like to, if I could, just voice a dissenting opinion, because I know listeners are waiting. So if I may, I think Brexit's been very positive for the metaphor industry. Very rarely, I think, have children learned what a metaphor is in quite the way they are now. For example, Theresa May and her mouldy jam, and uses underneath the Washington Post and are saying, this is a metaphor for Brexit. Because literally anything is a metaphor for Brexit.
It's a scandal that there aren't more funny Brexit supporting comedians to come on this show. Isn't it?
Yes. I'm afraid there's... Well, there are some, but I think they're perhaps not of our generation.
To confirm Susan's point, was it not Jean-Claude Juncker who said of Theresa May that I don't know what I'm metaphor?
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm anti-Brexit. I'm very much regretting my leave vote now.
Let that be minuted. That was an extraordinary thing from May, wasn't it, suddenly? And I mean, I don't know how much the sort of conversation had slowed down before May decided to tell everyone, but do you know what? If my jam's mouldy, I just scrape the mould off and crack on with it. She may, of course, just be sort of planting the seeds early on that she is perhaps going to pull a big sickie towards the end of March, perhaps, and she's just covering her tracks.
Does it go off, though? Because I've got jars at the back of my fridge that have probably been there since the, I would say, late 80s. Yeah. I still...
It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine, isn't it? It's stuff that just doesn't go... Mango chutney, I think, just goes on forever.
It gets bitter, I think. It gets bitter.
Yeah.
And you get more of it as well, don't you?
Depth of flavour.
Starts to get fizzy eventually, it sort of lifts the lid off and stuff. It's got a beautiful kind of visual quality.
It's fermented food, it's very on trend.
It's just it's boozy jam.
When they say Radio 4's too middle class, I don't know what they're talking about.
It sounds grim and surprising that she scrapes the mould off jam, but I heard Chris Grayling once ate most of a pigeon he found in the bin. Even the beak. So.
That's a shame. By the time Grayling's finished with the transport system, we'll be very reliant on pigeons.
Look, he's doing his best. It's just that he's not good enough.
And, you know, it puts me off even more because I won't have jam in the house. Please stop. Don't tweet me # not all jam.
I think a lot of the abuse is going to be centred on your leave votes. What has Theresa May done very recently, then, that makes herself look perhaps slightly less brilliant than she looked a day or so ago?
She lost a vote. Basically, it's the latest meaningful vote, although it's confusing because we've all slightly lost track of what meaningful means. Yeah. But there was the vote, and I think basically what it was Parliament last week or 2 weeks ago told her what to do, and she asked them to agree to a vote that she was indeed doing it, and they said no, she wasn't. I think.
Can't make it any clearer than that, can you?
Yeah. I am literally paid to understand this stuff, and I don't. Yeah. Sorry.
There was. It was a kind of, basically, she said, love me, and they said...
They said no.
No. This is a bit of good Brexit news at last, as Liam Fox has brokered a free trade deal with the Faroe Islands. They're going to send us barrel after fragrant barrel of delicious puffin meat, and in return we'll send them the mould we scrape off the top of our jam. It's an honour to be welcomed into a trade deal with a country as discerning and ethical as Switzerland, home of the Nazi gold hoards and Hollywood's least remorseful sex offenders. Also this week, Theresa May told the Cabinet that she scrapes the mould off her jam and eats what festers underneath. One might wonder why the Prime Minister leaves jam to go off in the first place, but she is a diabetic. A jar of jam is simply her version of the loaded gun Churchill always kept in his desk in case things went south. At the time of recording, Theresa May is still the Prime Minister, but by the time this goes out, who knows? It could be Jacob Rees-Mogg, it could be Jeremy Corbyn, it could be that pigeon Chris Grayling ate. 2 points to Hugo. Zoe, who's finding Labour particularly painful?
This is, of course, the ongoing story of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. Thanks for that lovely, joyful story. In a week of Valentine's, because isn't there something nice about a cat falling in love with a duckling or something?
There's an ISIS story this week. You can cover that if you want.
No. I'll have a crack at this. Here we go. Right. All of this comes off the back of Liverpool MP Luciana Berger, who has had a motion of no confidence laid against her, which has since been withdrawn, and has been subjected to horrific anti-Semitic abuse online and from various forces. From within her own party, John McDonald has said that it was nothing to do with anti-Semitism, it was rather because she was outspoken against Corbyn as a leader and had been very critical of him in the press, and, of course, his stance on anti-Semitism. So nothing at all to do with anti-Semitism.
It clashes with Labour's identity in a way that makes them find it so hard to deal with. People are always saying, well, there's more anti-Semitism on the right. And it's like, well, it's kind of, you know, what the far right is sort of for, historically, firstly. But also it's very, very different, because when you find anti-Semitism on the left, it's generally among people who they don't really know they're being anti-Semitic. They would believe they're not being anti-Semitic. If you say to them, do you hate Jews? They'd say no. But they do turn out just to sort of hate quite a lot of people. They think, well, I don't hate Jews, but I kind of hate people who like bagels and wear yarmulkes and have self-deprecating humour and are always going on about their son being a doctor and perhaps have family in Israel or even Pinner or somewhere. And and are always banging on about avoiding death and genocide and have jewellery with that stupid six-pointed star on it. And I hate those guys, but I'm not an anti-Semite. And that's basically Labour's problem.
Do we think Corbyn's a racist and anti-Semite? Personally, no, I do not at all. It's just unfortunate that he's been in certain circumstances where it does look a little bit orcs. Tunisia wreath dropping, little bit orcs. calling Hamas friends, tiny bit orcs. Corbyn, protesting against a mural that was definitely anti-Semitic being removed. Orcs again. So it's all very orcs. I think where people get confused with this is we think of the Labour Party as the party that is non-prejudiced, that is inclusive. But, of course, there are idiots, and Twitter has exposed these people too. Before Twitter, these people would have just barked at cars in the street. Every party has its extremes, except for perhaps for the Lib Dems. It's hard to imagine the extreme Lib Dem. What would they want? I don't know. We want to be more in the middle. When do we want it? At a time that's convenient for everybody.
You mentioned the Lib Dems. I'd like to make an appeal to the Lib Dems because it seems that Labour's tying itself in knots over anti-Semitism. And Syed Awasi produced a report accusing the Conservatives of having pockets of Islamophobia. Neither of these are much use to a Hindu like myself. If the Lib Dems can practice anti-Hinduism, I'd be very grateful because my career needs a boost. I could do with appearing as a commentator online, on newspapers, on the radio. I realise at the current rate, I'm well behind Amal Rajan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and Ramesh Ranganathan's mother. But nonetheless, it's about time us Hindus got a break. That's
well, listen, mate, the way to do it is to say you voted Leave and Brexit. I fully expect to have a burgeoning career as a Brexit comedian after publicly declaring the way I voted on the news quiz this evening, and I'm very proud of it. I didn't vote that way. I wouldn't be let back into Scotland again.
Well, you know, you've got to decide if that's worth it. This is Keir Starmer, who's called for tougher rules to expel anti-Semitic members of the Labour Party this week after Liverpool Wavertree CLP was accused of bullying Jewish MP Luciana Berger. Labour have sought to reassure Starmer, saying they will implement a strict rule of three strikes and you've only got a further six strikes before you face a threat of a caution. Of course, it's important to remember that other parties have their own problems with anti-Semitism. The Conservatives are aligned with openly anti-Semitic parties in the European Parliament, and for many years, Vince Cable had an ongoing personal beef with Noah. 2 points to Zoe. Paul, who's going to try switching it off and on again?
Vladimir Putin, or Vladimir Rebootin in this case, who's come up with the idea that Russia, our lovable rivals, should switch off the internet for, I don't know, a day, 2 days. It's not quite as mad as it seems. It's a security measure. I mean, the Russians are quite clearly dependent on the internet in many ways, not least the TripAdvisor reviews for Salisbury Cathedral. And so they reckon it's going to be very difficult to switch it all off. But I've got a word of advice. I know how to get into a situation where you cannot use the internet in any way, shape or form, and that is travel on Virgin trains. So that would be my advice for Putin. Get Virgin to take over the rail system and soon their internet will be absolutely bollocked.
It is possible to cut off a whole country from the internet. I think Mauritius, the internet got cut off because a trawler severed a cable. And then once there was a 75-year-old woman digging a hole, scavenging for metal in Georgia, and she managed to sever the entire internet for the whole of Armenia in 2011. I think they've got it back on now. It was a while back. But probably the longest I've spent without the internet, apart from the years sort of 0 to 25 or so, was when I went to jail, Miles. I was only there for a day. I was judging a debating competition. But but the best thing about jail is that there's no internet and no one's got phones. I mean, the best thing for me, I think they probably found it slightly bleak.
Is that the best thing about prison? I thought it was when you got drugs delivered by drone.
I mean, you can do that at home these days.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Perhaps prison's not so special.
Putin himself is a bit of a technophobe, isn't he? He famously doesn't like technology and avoids it. He thinks the internet is an American device used for espionage only. He doesn't have a smartphone. He won't use one, which is a shame because he's got such an Instagrammable life, hasn't he? So many perfect Instagram moments. You know, me on horse, Instagram pout, or fishing, pout, or... He's got a beautiful Instagram pout, looking dangerous and evil pout.
Yeah. Gordon Brown famously didn't like the internet, and this is true, the computer in his office, the monitor, he got people just to stick notes to it. So he'd sit down at his desk and look at it, and that's how you'd get a message to Gordon Brown, was by blue-tacking it to his monitor.
I was going to try and be one of those Instagram influencers, because I read in the papers, you know, about you can earn, like, thousands of pounds being an influencer, and I thought, well, I'll try and be an influencer. And I was sitting in my house thinking, oh, I'll take, you know, one of those Instagram photographs, counting and stuff, and I realised I'd had lunch, and I'd leaned forward to get my phone, and I dipped my boobs in my beans. And I thought, yeah. I don't think this is the kind of person you want as an influencer.
I always find
it's a Scottish equivalent of Kim Kardashian champagne on the bum, isn't it? Baps and beans.
And I suppose that is one of the hazards if you're going to lunch topless. That's why I always put a napkin on.
I was wearing it for miles.
That's the difference between the full English and the full Scottish.
No, that's not the kind of woman that brands are going to pay to advertise things.
Except for beans, maybe. Is she the new face of Heinz? Not exactly the face.
Oh my god, you worked so hard for a law degree and then it's just selling beans.
Take that, Russia. This is the news that Russia is planning to unplug from the internet, wait 5 seconds and then plug it back in again. Putin has said that rather than the internet, he prefers people to use their memories to recall great moments from recent Russian history. Russia's back-to-back Ashes victories, Putin's glorious return trip to Mars, and the wonderful spring morning when he married Meghan Markle. For some of our older listeners, the internet is like a sort of big post office, but imagine you can send 1 million letters a second and most of them would make you blush. 2 points to Paul. And at the end of round one, the scores are Zoe and Hugo have 4, and so too do Susan and Paul. All to play for as we go into round two. OK, this is absolutely Nat's chuff tight. This is it. This is just nothing between you. So just focus. Never mind the funnies. Points, points, points. I like the points, Susan. I'm here for the points, yeah? It's about the points.
Is this about the beans again?
Is this where the bean lady lives? The bean lady. What would be wrong with being called the bean lady?
No, it was the delightful... Yes, it's slightly like Molly Weir there. Is this where the bean lady lives?
I've just come away across the wet Africa. The bean lady. Just one of my... Yeah, I know you don't think I've got range. All to play for. Focus, focus, focus.
Okay. Yep.
And then will there be bonus points in offer this round, Zeb?
Well, there may very well be. I'm keeping notes.
Just saying.
We've always been told that the scores don't matter. Suddenly you're changing. Do they matter today? Is there an actual prize?
They always matter, yeah. Yeah, there is a prize.
Is there?
Yeah.
There's never been a prize before.
No, there's a big prize today.
And one of you will go.
Yeah, that's right. There is a winner, and then there's a proper sort of relic. Yeah, it's like, yeah. There is one of you is currently in the news quiz relegation zone, and you'll be dropped to the Now Show. Right. A move side. Completely unprofessional. We start round two with an advert from Dunelm Mill.
This easy assembly folding bed frame goes up fast in any space not usually used for sleeping in. Perfect for a quicker action.
Our thanks to Adrian Lush for sending us that. Hugo, who might not have had his finest hour this week?
OK, so this is John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor. He was asked this week by the website Politico. It was the end of an interview, and they said, Winston Churchill, was he a hero or a villain? And MacDonald said instantly, villain, Tony Pandy. And what he meant, he was talking about when Churchill, in I think 1910 or 1911, sent troops to break up a riot by striking miners in Wales. And it was quite bad. One person was killed. And, you know, I wouldn't defend it. And that's what MacDonald was talking about when he said Churchill was a villain, which you can kind of understand his point, but it does sort of leave you thinking, this Churchill guy, I wonder if he did anything else. And it's kind of like, you know, if you're asked the question, Adolf Hitler, hero or villain? And you're kind of going, well, you know, I'm going to go with the hero option because he once did a great job painting a front room in Düsseldorf. You know, it's kind of... it's an odd fight, you know, but Labour seems to manage to get itself into these situations, so that this sort of dominated the news agenda for about half a day with everyone debating over whether Churchill was a hero or a villain. It could have been worse. I was on Twitter this afternoon and basically half of social media was braced for Ken Livingstone to turn up on television, kind of going, you know who else didn't like Churchill? That fortunately didn't happen. And, you know, what's strange about it is obviously MacDonald, I mean, he kind of sort of meant it, but he probably didn't really mean it. It's like we're in this world now that when we say something like, even when we have views, it's often not even that we really have views, we're just kind of trying to show which team we're on. And MacDonald was obviously thinking, well, my team are the guys who don't like Churchill, so I've got to send out a signal to them. And so that's kind of what he did. It's a tribal declaration, and I don't really want to play that game, which is why, if you ask me whether I thought Churchill was a hero or a villain, I would say... who? And then run away.
Is it just possible that we can have a more adult discussion about whether Winston Churchill was a hero or a villain? He has the gratitude of a nation. He was voted number one in the Greatest Britain's poll of 2002. He has that default gratitude. Can we now all grow up and accept that people can be good people and bad people as well? It's called the Paul McCartney and the Frog Chorus argument.
That was a really great song, Paul. I
didn't Paul McCartney had the Frog Chorus. Mahatma Gandhi had very dubious sexual morality. Nelson Mandela claimed that meeting the Spice Girls was the greatest day of his life. We all make mistakes. And it's a matter of record that Winston Churchill enabled the death of millions of Bengalis during the Bengali famine of the 1940s. This is not an opinion, it is a matter of record. What is an opinion is how you weigh it up. He didn't do some very good things, he's underplaying it. He did some terrible things, and yet he was the leader that Britain needed in the Second World War. Both of those are true. I can sit here and happily call him a hero. My granddad, who was imprisoned by the British in the 1940s in the Great Bengali Famine, has a different opinion, and I completely respect that opinion, not least because he's dead and I can't argue with him now. But when he came to Britain in 1983, we went on a great tour of Great Britain, and he refused to go to Blenheim Palace, because my dad's car had been insured by Churchill. That is the sort of pathological... I'd actually like to live in a grown-up society where both opinions are valid and neither opinion is attacked.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. He wasn't a saint by any means, was he, Churchill? But he got us through World War II and rallied the troops and rallied the forces, and for that we should be grateful. Otherwise, as people always say, we'd be speaking German, but I very much doubt it because we're so bad at languages in this country. We'd still be using the phrase book and getting it horribly wrong. So,
this is John McDonnell, who, when asked at a Politico website or event for a one-word answer on whether Churchill was a hero or villain, replied, Tony Pandy, villain. Nicola Soames responded by calling him a Poundland Lenin. Sadly, this isn't a real product. However, Home Bargains are doing an incredibly Moorish chocolate Stalin for just 40p. The savoury sausage Mao's are also nice, but do make sure you heat them through thoroughly. Tony Pandy, where Churchill sent the army to quell a riot, is thought to be the inspiration for Fireman Sam's hometown of Ponty Pandy, which makes sense of the episode where Sam goes on strike and is then shot by a sniper. Winston Churchill was voted the greatest Briton in a BBC poll, although that was in 2002, of course, before the heady days of Cleggmania. 2 points to Hugo. Susan, which sharp decline is really going to sting?
This is a very important story. Insects are declining. 40% of insect species are dwindling globally. Now, that's very important because without insects, our ecosystem cannot survive. This is an important thing. So we can all do something about it. I'm doing something about it genuinely. Bought a house, not boasting, just fact. The back garden was concreted over for some reason. Hopefully there's nothing under the patio. I'm bulldozing the whole back garden and I'm going to make it into a wildlife ecosystem thing to attract insects into the garden. And we need to start doing that, because if we don't do that, the insects are all going to die out. And then we will die because the insects are dead, which is actually not that funny.
Right. And what's the exact link between the insects and the survival of the insects and our survival?
Well, they do things like they pollinate things, don't they? They go from... I sound like a 10-year-old child. Well... So other things eat the insects.
Yeah.
And the insects do things to help us, like build car parks. I don't know.
a lot of civil engineering, isn't there? That's really... Is a world without insects the Brexit you voted for?
I would say
almost certain.
I mean, I did want to know if insects not from the UK were coming into the UK. That was one of the key things. I was promised we would have more control over the immigration of insects.
That's right. They all said there was that big bust. There'll be less malaria on it.
Yes. If they're British insects, then I'm OK.
You've got midges in Scotland.
They are very important. We have a midgie machine.
You're making them?
No. In the midges, because if you go to Arran, and it's unlivable with the amount of midges. It's absolutely horrific. It's just horrible. So it sucks in the midges and gets rid of the midges in a small area.
So but why are these insects dying?
What you do is you then make a midgie cake out of the midges. What? So you use bacon fat. And you put the dead midges in with it and you put it out for the birds so that they still have the food. So you make a midgie cake for the birds. Why are you all looking at me like this?
No, it sounds, it sounds perfectly reasonable.
I feel responsibility here. I'm partly to blame. 3 years ago, I got stung by a wasp on a bus in Leeds. And for 2 weeks after that, I harboured violent thoughts towards wasps. And wandered around the streets of Leeds looking for any wasp, bee or even hornet. Yeah. Even ones that weren't responsible in any way for the actions of that single wasp.
It's good that you can admit that, though, now.
I can admit it now.
Everyone can forgive you now because you've said that out loud.
And coincidentally, I'm starring in Bee, the movie. Yeah.
Anyone know how many species of insect there are?
A lot.
Close.
28,000. 29,000. 29,500.
There could be as many as 30 million species.
Close.
And I tell you what, all of them are disgusting. This is new analysis which shows a drastic collapse in the world's insect population. How were we supposed to know? The demise of the insects was first noticed in the 50s and 60s and has reached alarming proportions in recent decades, much like syncopated popular music. I'm not saying the two are definitely linked, but you never see Lonnie Donegan and 3,000 bees in the same room together, do you? The die-off is being attributed to pesticide use, which denies butterflies the honourable death they so obviously crave. A single nail driven through the thorax before being mounted in the Natural History Museum. Since 1947, the bee population has declined by over 40%. Now, I don't want to point fingers, but I reckon it's got something to do with Winnie the Pooh eating all the honey, the podgy, trouserless pervert. Two points to Susan. Zoe, who's happy now?
This is this is a bit of research that's come out by the Resolution Foundation that has found that after 7 years of collecting data, we are actually at our happiest at the ages of 16 and 70, and that we are at our least happy and feeling satisfied in our mid-20s and around about the age of 50. Now, I don't know how I feel about this. I remember me at 16, not a happy 16-year-old, and if that was my peak, my God. My goodness. And imagine saying to a 17-year-old, well, you had last year, and it's now 53 years until you'll feel that joy again. think the three major things that make you happier, apparently, are having a bit of money, being in a good relationship, and your health. And then everything else is just gravy. And weirdly, one of the happiest professions are the clergy. And I think that's probably because they know the big boss doesn't actually exist, so they can just do whatever they want.
They're in on the great scam.
They're in on the great... And after that, the second happiest are air traffic control, because they must feel a little bit like God. So it's just having that control.
Air traffic controllers are the second happiest.
Which is strange, isn't it? Because it's such a stressful job, but they are one of the happiest professions. Yeah.
Perhaps they don't take it as seriously as we do.
No, maybe... We like to think they are, but maybe it's just like a giant game of battleships for them. 4B, already got one there.
Oh, that was close, wasn't it, Tony? That was close. Do you want anything out of the machine?
Yeah.
Hopefully kind of laissez-faire.
What have you been doing today, Simon? Well, I've had a bit of fun pretending I could see a drone around Gatwick. Really brightened up my afternoon.
I reckon they've got this wrong. I reckon... It's a survey, right? And I reckon what their mistake was... I think they asked loads of 16-year-olds who were just really into being asked questions on surveys, so they were delighted. Mm. And all the 70-year-olds they asked were happy, because all the ones who aren't happy are dead. Yeah.
This is really the happiest people, the people who have time to fill in the survey.
Yeah, and if you have time to fill in a survey and you're prepared to fill in a survey, what really delights you is someone coming along with a survey.
Yeah.
Self-fulfilling. Think about it.
And do you imagine that there's sort of planes just endlessly circling our airports while huge numbers of people in traffic control are sort of filling in questionnaires?
That's why you're in a stacking system. Yeah.
Well, but they ask
people saying in confessional, we're just going, yeah, that's right, keep talking. But they're filling in more boxes. Very happy on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd say. Right, when was your last confession? Right, yeah. I do like jam, actually. Yes, I'll give that a 10.
But they asked like 7,000 people, right? Statistically, how many of those were air traffic controllers? This is madness. Like, one? Mm. One happy man?
Yeah. And they might be, like, seriously ill. Yeah. Worth thinking about, isn't it? next time you're flying.
Doesn't strike me as the most insightful of polls. After 7 years of polling, they've worked out that someone's good health, ability to have a job and a partner... Who knew? Seriously, who knew? I was trying to work out what the theory is, and who knew that the ages of 16 and 70, the two ages that you're not paying any tax whatsoever or filling any tax forms, you'd be happy. And I think the 16-year-olds are happy because they don't know how shit life really is. And the 70-year-olds are happy because they do know full well how shit life really is, and they're going to leave it soon, so...
What is happiness? Because, obviously, your wedding day is often said to be... People always say that, don't they? It's the happiest day of my life. And I did feel happy, but yesterday I put on an old coat I hadn't worn for ages and I found a fiver in the pocket and I think I felt just as happy. Yeah. Nothing like finding money you didn't know. You're like, oh, a fiver!
I've not met a huge amount of 16-year-olds that are absolutely delighted, because you don't necessarily know who you are, you're a bit confused, all that kind of stuff. I'm looking forward to being 70 because I will know who I am. And I think that's who you will be? I'm going to be a woman. I'm going to be a woman who leaves the house in the morning with a pram with a cat in it. And when someone says, oh, is that your grandson? I'll go, yes. And I'll pull back the blanket and there'll be a cat. But I'll be an old lady, so they won't say, that's a cat. They'll say, oh, he looks like you. And I'll say, I know. And I will walk around the park with my cat in a pram, perfectly compos mentis, but happy as Larry, with a cat in a pram. And I'll become notorious and people will come to see. See, is that the bean lady? No, it's the cat in the pram. I will have extra life. As
How is it she makes the cats come to her? Well, interesting story. This is a study which has found that British people are happiest at the ages of 16 and 70, the two ages where you do nothing but stay in your room all day, take drugs and watch television. Anxiety levels tend to rise between their mid-20s and their mid-50s as people realise that this really is it. So the answer to happiness is clearly young blood, or at least being rich enough to drink it regularly. 2 points to Zoe. Paul, who pursued some naughty habits?
Right, so this is my favourite story of the week, not least how topical it is. I'm going to take you back to 1318, the year 1318. For those of you that don't know how long ago that is, it's about 700 years or 6,300 times the gestation period of a ferret. Should get an extra bonus point for doing that maths during the show, I feel. But anyway, this is research from the University of York's Borthwick Archives, who've been checking the records of the Archbishop of York, and they've found a woman called Joan of Leeds, who's not a mythical figure that has featured in the audience of every episode of Countdown since 1986, but is a nun. And in 1318, Joan of Leeds wanted to escape from the nunnery. So she did what everyone would do. She built an effigy of herself, which she had buried after faking her own death. This is absolutely amazing, because she wanted to follow the way on record of carnal lust. That's why she wanted to leave. What I love about this story is not just that it combines the plots of The Sound of Music, The Shawshank Redemption, and Debbie Does Dallas. Not only plays into the fantasies of us faking our own deaths, we've all had that fantasy before. Ironically, mine is in the throes of carnal lust rather than to pursue it. But it's also... December the 14th, you're all invited, and... But it's also the fact that 3 days ago, nobody had heard of Joan of Leeds, and now she has her own Wikipedia page already. And the exact words from Wikipedia were, after escaping to York, Joan was eventually discovered in Beverley. That is my favourite line from Wikipedia of all times. Joan is an absolute hero, escaping from the nunnery to pursue her own carnal lusts. Mm. What a great story for Valentine's Day that is.
She sounds like the sort of Joan of Leeds sort of goes viral sort of after a Question Time episode. Oh, God, remember when Joan of Leeds was on? Shocking.
I don't think at the age of 44 I could find a new role model, but I think this woman really is it. I mean, I think I once pretended to be dead to get out of PE, but that's about as far as... I think it was cross-country and I didn't want to run around a field. I think it's amazing, and I just love the headlines. Nun pretends to be dead to pursue life of lust. It's the feel-good story we've all been waiting for.
I don't understand it, because she faked her own death and then they built a sort of an effigy of herself, which they then buried, which means they'll have spent quite a lot of time with it, thinking it was her. Mm. And I was thinking, well, the nuns hadn't seen a naked person before. But then I thought, no, they'd have seen themselves. So I don't understand.
The truth of the story is they think that she had help, that her colleagues and accomplices, unknown to the superiors, helped her and all assisted her to escape, which I quite love, the idea that all these people helped her get laid. Mm. We've got to do our best...
Like a sort of prisoner of war story, you know, like having a sort of making a sort of false soldier kind of thing, marching him out to the parade ground or whatever. Having it, come, we've got to do this. Joan's absolutely ganting on it. Everyone. or however they spoke in the 14th century, but I imagine they used Scottish colloquialisms. That is one of the great words, isn't it, Ganting? Do you think there's been a rash of these? I mean, how often do you think a nun just thinks, hang on a minute?
Well, so I was at boarding school, and we...
Did you escape because of...
Well, we... I mean,
you weren't happy with the loving you were getting there?
Sort of, yes. We used to like make dummies in our beds to go out drinking. You'd make up something that looked like yourself, you'd sort of pad it out and stuff. And we got caught one time because my friend Eddie forgot to have a head.
Schoolboy era.
Yeah.
Also, in the 14th century, time was of the essence, wasn't it? I mean, you know, you only lived to about 40, so you probably got to 18 and went, I'm having a midlife crisis. I've got to get out of here and do something with my life. I've only got 3 teeth left.
This is the work of a team of medieval historians who have found evidence that a 14th century nun, Joan of Leeds, faked her own death in order to escape her convent and pursue, in the words of the Archbishop of the time, the way of carnal lust. Her exploits were recorded on the hit tapestry Joan Does Canterbury. Archivists are shocked. They always thought Joan of Leeds was a Miranda, when she's clearly a total Samantha. Joan was ostracised for her serious violation of the Fourth Commandment, sisters before misters. It's not known what happened to Joan, but we can only assume that she eventually died of being an absolute legend. Joan escaped by leaving a pile of pillows under her bedsheets as a decoy. This isn't the first time this has happened. It turns out that between 1846 and 1878, Pope Pius IX was just a broomstick with googly eyes and a hat. 2 points to Paul. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting that they'd like to share?
This was sent in by Michael Byrne. He found it on the Historic House's website. Take a 90-minute walk with Lester Hillman, international award-winning planner, academic advisor and accredited guide, who shares what he's picked up from hanging around the back streets of King's Cross for 5 days.
Paul.
Unusually, mine's the clean one. This is a nice headline on the Eastern Daily Press website, sent from Hayden Charles in Wynmundham in Norfolk. One for detectives here. Pie shop opens on site of former pet store.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final score. Hugo and Zoe have 8, but this week's winners are Susan and Paul with 9. Before we leave you, here is a notice for customers spotted in Planet Organic in Muswell Hill in London.
If you want to use our loo, press 345 and turn knob.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the News Quiz Extra were Hugo Rifkin, Zoe Lyon, Susan Cullman and Paul Sinner. In the chair was Miles Jupp and the news was read by me, Zeb Soames. The chair script was written by Catherine Brinkworth, Gabby Hutchinson-Crouch and Benjamin Partridge, with additional material by Alice Etches, Nathan Roberts and Phoebe Roy. The producer was Luke Mason and it was a BBC Studios production.